Jeff and I get together, and we usually go man, woman, man, woman, man, woman. This year, it's man and this guy. I met a couple probably 4 or 5 years ago now. And he just got wonderful recovery. And the best thing I like about this guy is there's no strings attached. You know, he's just for me being around him, and he's helped me and helped my recovery. And I'm sure that tonight that you'll get something out of his story, because I've never heard his story, but just heard bits and pieces. But I want to introduce you tonight, Willie P. Scott.
Turn your cell phones off or on vibrate. Thank you,
Thank you, Brent, for the introduction. I can't wait to hear what this guy's going to say. I'd like to congratulate the group, for this is the 15th anniversary. And I believe it's a big book study group, and that's incredible. And I would like to thank the group members who decided to make it a big book study group, because I'm biased. I think every meeting should be a big book study meeting. As you probably know, I do come from Scotland, and my name is Willie Burns, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a very grateful recovered alcoholic, and we'll get to that later on. I'd like to thank, was it Bob? You read out the extract from chapter 5, because that's the piece of literature that really helped to change my life and save my life and made my life worth living. You know, there's so much to say in so little time. I'm going to have to learn to speak in shorthand. You know, one thing I will say is that tonight you're not going to be subjected to a drunkalogue. You know, I really want to talk about the miracle of my recovery. And that's not a word that I use lightly, but that's what it's been. It's been an absolute miracle. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I love it with a passion. And it wasn't always like that, I can assure you. But I feel that I do have to warn you that where I come from in the west of Scotland, I've been accused of being a big book thumper. And that's a charge that I plead guilty to with no apologies, none at all. I was the only boy in a family of 6 sisters. And I often tell people in the rooms that I was 3 times as unfortunate in life as Cinderella. She only had 2 ugly sisters. And no, I didn't wear the hand-me-downs and stuff like that, you know. And growing up, both my parents were alcoholic. So I know what it's like. They live in an alcoholic home. Now, I remember in my early teens, I vowed that I would never drink. And I meant it. I'll never drink. Because I saw what booze does to people. You know, it turns them from like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, or Mrs. Hyde, or whatever. I dropped out of high school at 18, just to spite my father. I got married within 6 months. just to get the hell out of the house. The girl I married, she was only 16. We had three children within 3 years and 10 months. Good Irish Catholics. You know, even when I was in high school, I worked in the gambling industry for years, from the age of 15. So whenever I left school and I got married, we moved down to London. I was only 19 at the time. And within a comparatively short period of time, I was put in charge of about 40 betting shops in the London area. And the reason for that is that gambling had been legalised in Scotland for years before it was legalised in England. And when it was legalised in England, they couldn't find any experienced staff. So a lot of us got headhunted down there. I didn't start drinking till I was about 21, 22. And I remember the night that I had my first drink. And we were at, it was a staff dinner dance at Christmas time. And some of the guys I was with, you know, they were saying, you know, Willie, what do you want to drink? And I didn't know. So one of them would hand me his glass and say, well, try that. And I took a sip of beer and lager and vodka and gin. I didn't like it. It was vile, terrible stuff. Then one of the guys handed me his glass and said, Willie, try that. And I took a sip out of it. And I fell in love with it. It was whiskey and Coca-Cola. And that was my drink. Thanks, man. You know, my drinking didn't start off alcoholically. It was a gradual progression because this is a fatal progressive illness. But I didn't know that at that time. As I say, I'm not going to bore you with a drunkologue. After my youngest child was born, Geraldine, our married life finished because my ex-wife was a very devout Catholic. And I'm in my early 20s and I'm living down in London. You know, in the swinging 60s, in the permissive society. And I certainly was. And I don't take any pride in saying that. But it got to the stage, you know, that with the atmosphere at home and with my drinking, I didn't want to go home at night because I knew that the big picture would start all over again. You know, our bedroom became a battleground, and that's fact. I only drank for about 6 years. And then at the end of that time, we'd move back up to Scotland. And of course, every time I would take a drink, you know, my ex-wife, she was nagging at me. You know, look what booze did to your family. Look at my family. None of our family drank. God help them. They probably needed it. But that's the way it was. I remember 1970, just to shut them up, you know, the in-laws or the outlaws, whatever you call them. They'd arranged for me to go and speak to a Catholic priest. It had been many years since I'd been away from the Catholic Church. You know, I turned my back on it many years earlier. But just to get him off my back, I went to see this guy that night. And I drove about 20-odd miles. And I remember the two of us were sitting in a room in two armchairs across from each other. And I'd already been told that this man, the Catholic priest, and his name was Father Isaac McLaren. And I was told that he was an alcoholic. So when I went and I sat and spoke with Isaac, he started telling me a lot about his drinking. Then out of the blue, he said to me, Willie, do you think you might be alcoholic? I felt insulted. I really did. You know, I remember thinking, you know, did nobody tell this guy who I was? You know, I'm sitting there, you know, with the lightweight mohair suits on, smoking K-head with cigars, pockets full of money. It wasn't my money, it was my employer's. I'd stolen it. You know? I was very generous with other people's money. But I remember saying to him that day, you know, no way. I can't be an alcoholic. You know, I don't drink wine and beer, you know. It's nothing but the best for me. I only drink Bell's or Grouse whiskey. And that's when he explained to me that alcohol is not a drink. It's a drug called ethanol or ethyl alcohol. And he said, like, every drug that's on the market today, there is a certain proportion of the population who will have an allergic reaction to that drug. That didn't make sense to me. But you know, even the degree of denial was so strong in me. And I'm sitting there confronted with this man, and I'm saying to him, you know, but I can't be an alcoholic. I can't be. I've got too much money. And he said, yeah, just keep drinking, son. It won't last you long. And again, I come back at him and I said, you know, but I can't be an alcoholic. I'm far too intelligent. And I remember his answer. He looked at me and he said, yes, Willie, you're so effing intelligent, you can't count to one. If you don't take the first drink, you can't get drunk. I couldn't wait to get away from him that night. And you know where I went. The nearest bar. That's where I went. A year after it, the atmosphere at home was still, you could have cut it with a knife. My drinking had certainly progressed. I remember one night in the summer, it was in June of 1971. I'd finished work in the gambling industry at 6 o'clock. And me and all the staff and a lot of other friends, we all went across the road and into the cocktail bar. And down the stairs, you know, the dolly berths were the mini skirts and the big outstanding futures. That's what I drank. And I remember we left there at 11 o'clock that night. And we were going to a party on the other side of Glasgow. And I remember going to the party and we all brought bottles of this and bottles of that and whatever. I remember coming out of that party, and it must have been the early hours of the morning, and it was pouring down with rain. And I lived about 26 miles away. And some of my friends were gathered around me. I could hardly stand. You know, but no matter how drunk I was like a homing pigeon. I always wanted to go home. And some of my friends were pleading with me, you know, well, you know, you can't drive, just stay here tonight. You'll be all right, son. You know, one of them even tried to take my car keys off me. You ever try to take the car keys off an alky? Yeah? God almighty. I got in the car and I started driving. That's 40 years ago. And to this day, I have no recollection of what happened next. I don't know. My first recollection was being given the last rites by another Catholic priest. My next recollection after that, there was a big black doctor standing over me with a clipboard asking me a load of stupid questions like, do you know what your name is? And I told him. And he said, do you know what happened to you? And all I had to do was look around the bed that I was tied into. And I said, yeah, I smashed the car up. He said, that's right, son. Both my legs were in traction. My two arms were broken, they were in plaster. It's a matter of medical record that I had more than 250 stitches from the neck up. There was no laminated windscreens in those days. You know, the windscreen just shattered and I get most of it in the face. Even 6 weeks later, I was still spitting out tiny pieces of glass from the inside of my mouth. I got the steering wheel in my chest. My ribs were broken. My pelvis was broken. to tell me the engine ended up in the front seat beside me. My right thigh was broken in 4 places. My right shin was broken in 3. And I broke every bone in my right ankle. My left leg was broken in 2 places. My right wrist, you know, it was nearly severed off. They tied the tendons together under the skin. And they told me then that I would never straighten my right arm or use my right hand again. They also told me that I would never walk again without a steel caliper. And my attitude, as it was all my life, was, I'll show them. I'll show them. You know, I've often said that I've never met anyone with more willpower and determination than this wee guy standing here tonight. You tell me I can't do something, just stand back. I'll show you. In the first couple of weeks, my wife would come in to visit me twice a day. In the first 2 weeks, she was always dressed in black. There was a lot of people praying for me at that time. I think most of them were praying that I wouldn't make it. I'm only a couple of weeks in there when my wife came in and told me that one of my girlfriends was pregnant. And I'm lying now. You can imagine it. And I would have done anything to try and keep my marriage together. If they would have asked me to do the Apache war dance in the middle of George Square in Glasgow, I would have done it. But she said to me, she'd met a man who lives near us. His name is Pat Rooney. And Pat was a member of AA. Would I mind if Pat came and spoke to me? So a few days later, this guy came in, and he sat beside me, and he started telling me all about his drinking. And I felt sorry for the poor guy. I spent 4.5 months in Glasgow Royal Infirmary before I was transferred to another hospital for a month. But during that 4.5 months, the priest who had given me the last rites, he was the hospital chaplain, and his chapel was straight across the road from the hospital. He would come in the evenings and he would sit with me for hours, and you know, I poured my heart out to this guy. He was like the brother that I never had. Eventually, after I got home, and they allowed me home still with the traction on my legs, you know, I lay in Glasgow Royal with 2 chest expanders, one tied onto the top of the bed and one at the bottom of the bed, day and night. Just going like that. I was determined to straighten my arm. I did. You know, at that time, they gave me a little sponge ball that you could squash with 2 fingers in this hand. But in that hand, I couldn't budge it. That's 40 years ago. I've still got a sensation of pins and needles in the palm of my hand. That's how bad I was damaged. Eventually, I got home. And again, you know, the atmosphere at home picked up a bit because by now I was confined to barracks. I couldn't get out anyway, not with this traction on my leg. But that priest that gave me the last rites, he would come out and visit me on a regular basis. I wore that caliper for the best part of a year. And I was going in and out 3 times a week for physiotherapy. And eventually, after another year, I managed to get back to work. And it didn't take long before I started drinking again. Now, I hadn't had a drink for nearly 2 years. But eventually, after I got back to work, I started drinking. Because I was back with all the old team. Again, things at home went downhill fast. And I remember, you know, again, being under pressure. I agreed that I'd go to my very first AA meeting. I remember it was one Sunday afternoon, 2 guys came to my house in a car, and they picked me up and they took me to a meeting about 30 miles away. And the meeting is at home, they run for 2 hours. You know, you get a chairman who will read out the preamble like we've done tonight, and then you'll get a speaker for an hour, then the second part of the meeting, then you're around the room for the second hour. I remember sitting there that night, and I couldn't tell you what happened in the first part of the meeting. But during the second part, when they're going around the room, it seemed to me that everybody in that room all knew about me, because they were all talking about me. And to show you just how clever I was, I'm sitting there and I'm racking my brain trying to think, how did they know? How did they? Then I thought, you know, they really must think I'm stupid. I know how this thing works. When those two dummies pick me up in the car to bring me over, she's been on the phone to them. And they've all got together and they've said, now when it's your turn, you say this, and when it's your turn, you say that. And I don't want you to think I was paranoid. That's just the way it was. I remember starting to go to meetings, and they suggested to me at that time that that I go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And to the best of my recollection, I did that. Excuse me. I went to the 90 meetings in 90 days. I remember the next night, I picked up my wife and kids, and I was taking them down to visit her parents. And I stopped at a liquor store, and I remember saying to her, well, I mean, that's it. You know, I've done the 90 meetings in 90 days. Now I'm cured. I'm cured. So I'll just go in and get a quarter bottle of whiskey. By that time, she'd be going to Al-Anon. And she didn't go ballistic like she normally did. She just said, well, Willie, if that's what you want to do, you carry on and do it. And I didn't know then that that quarter bottle of whiskey was the start of me going in and out the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous for the next 12 years. And during that 12 years, the only thing I ever did right was I kept coming back. I probably qualify for the Guinness Book of Records from the number of things I'm in and out of AA. Some of the guys in the meetings would say to me, how long are you back for this time, Willie? I'm sure some of them are taking bets on me. And as you know, I mean, I come from a different country, and it's a different culture. And you would imagine that AA would be the same. But I can assure you, you don't realize just how fortunate you are for the AA that you have over here. And this is not a criticism of the AA as it was at that time, 40 years ago. These are observations based on my own personal experience. And a lot of the meetings that I went to at that time, anyone in the room who mentioned God or higher power or Jesus Christ, you were asked to leave the room. We're not here for that nonsense. We're only here for booze. And all I was listening to was war stories. Night after night after night. There was no recovery. There was one man in our area, and he was Mr. AA. His name was Frank. And at that time, Big Frank had 29 years. And I've often heard this man standing at a podium and saying, well, I've never read the big book. I didn't want to become an effing expert. That's true. That's true. Thankfully, it's a little bit better today, but not much. I was saying to someone else earlier this evening, the only one thing wrong with AA in the west of Scotland is full of drunks. During that 12-year period, the people in the meetings told me, you know, if I carry on drinking, you know, various things could happen to me. I didn't believe them. They called them the yes. And over that 12-year period, I lost my wife, my three kids, my home, my jobs. I lost two businesses. I did quite a number of one-night stands in police stations, and I ended up in Sauchon Prison in Edinburgh. I lost any sense of self-respect or decency or dignity. Everything went. And it got to the stage that I just didn't want to go on anymore. There was nothing left to go on for. Nothing. And my last drink was on the 23rd of March, 1985. I remember that night, the early hours of the morning, and I'm lying on the edge of my bed. I'd been living on my own. I remember bringing up pints of blood. And I remember at that time saying probably the most honest prayer that I've ever said in my life. And I said, God, for F's sake, help me. Help me. And the next morning, there was a man came to my house. And his name is Andy Davison. And Andy brought with him a copy of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a copy of the book lying at home for 7 years. Never looked at the damn thing. Nobody in the meeting spoke about the steps or the program. Nothing. You know? Like people used to say to me, oh, Willie, don't you read that big book? That'll get you screwed up. I'd rather be screwed up than screwed down. But Andy came to the house that morning and he brought the copy of the book. And I want to see if I can put this so it doesn't fall. And Andy introduced me to the book Alcoholics Anonymous. But before he even opened it up, he showed me that this is a textbook. And it tells me that right in the bottom. This is the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a textbook is a book to be studied and referred back to. This group tonight, this is called the Hope Group. And that's the tremendous hope that Andy gave me that morning when he came to my house. Because he opened the book up, and on the very first page, up there it says in big letters, Alcoholics Anonymous. And right underneath it says, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. You see, he was quick to point out that the word recovered doesn't mean cured. And it tells me that in the book. It says, remember, we are not cured of alcoholism. That all I have is a daily reprieve, contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. Then Andy turned to chapter 5. The extract that was read out tonight by Bob. And in the book, right after the three pertinent ideas, Andy showed me the next line in the book. The next line says, being convinced, we are now at step 3. Now don't forget, I'd gone in and out of AA for 12 years. I'd been at hundreds of meetings, thousands of meetings. I'd heard chapter 5 read every time. I went in there and out there. It meant nothing to me. You know, but Andy said to me, so all of a sudden this is chapter 5 and now it says, you know, we are now at step 3. And Andy said to me, so where's step 1 and step 2? I said, well, I don't know. He said, well, that's in the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters in the book. I didn't know that. I didn't know that chapter 5 only tells me how to take step 3 and step 4. I didn't know that. Chapter 6 is called Into Action. And that whole chapter tells me how to take steps 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. I didn't know that. And there's another one, chapter 7. It's called Working with Others. And that's a whole chapter on the 12th step. And I didn't know that. And that's one of the reasons why I'm here tonight. Andy suggested to me that I start and study this book, no more than 2 pages a day, and to believe every word in it. And he told me, you know, don't go beyond 2 pages. So I would try that, and I would stick to the 2 pages, and I would read them 10, 20, 50 times in a day. And at times, you know, having read it, it'd be like somebody switched a light on in my head. And I think, that's what you mean. Jesus. I was the fourth member of the very first big book study group in the west of Scotland. There was only 3 guys there. I was the fourth one. Used to call us the God Squad. You know, that's a compliment. You know what? We were all living in welfare at that time. I'd been banned for drunk driving for a second time. I was banned for 3 years, and it's mandatory. But Andy and Felix and Tommy, they would come to my house almost every day or every night. And Andy had a car, he would pick us up and take us to meetings, and we would come back, we'd all come into my house, and we'd have our own meeting, and we were all reading and studying the book. I managed to borrow a set of cassettes of Joe and Charlie, the big book guys. And listening to them sitting at home on my own, they tell you, you know, as you're listening to it, you open the book, they tell you the page you're talking about, for me to underline the parts that are relevant to me. So I started doing that, and they're talking about some of the pages I've read 100 times. But somehow just listening to them, it made it sound so simple. Then I started beating myself up again. How did I not think of that? You know, I wasn't meant to. Simple as that. It was incredible. I've learned so much from this book. I love this book. I love this program. I really do. My whole life in the last 28 years centers around Alcoholics Anonymous. But you know, in the first step, it doesn't ask me to admit I'm an alcoholic. Sorry. It's not just a matter of me going to the meetings and saying my name's Willie, I'm an alcoholic. The first step asked me to admit that I was powerless over alcohol. And for me to find out just what makes us be very powerless over alcohol, I found the answers in this book. You know, I'd heard people in the rooms talking about the allergy, and I didn't believe them. I thought it was just a plausible excuse. You know, but when I saw it written down in black and white in the doctor's opinion, you know, that we have an adverse reaction to alcohol, even when I read it in black and white, that was not enough to convince me. What really convinced me was when I realized that this book was written before I was even born. They knew I was coming. They knew I was coming. I'm the guy they wrote this book about. You know, I had so many problems that I despaired of ever solving them. So I found out that, okay, you know, common sense tells me, if you're allergic to strawberries, you don't eat strawberries. So that wee bit made sense. But the other part of the illness is that I suffer from a mental obsession. This book talks about the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. That's me. Was it someday, somehow, I'd be able to do just 2 things. I'd be able to control and enjoy my drinking. And I've been trying to do that for years. And it says in there, it says, the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. And on the 23rd of March, 1985, and I don't say this to try and impress anyone or to try and scare anyone, I was ready to put a rope around my neck and finish it. I know a lot about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Then it says that my life had become unmanageable. My life became unmanageable because I was powerless over alcohol. But it was something else I had going, not in my favour, for 42 years of my life, I had an idiot trying to run my life, the great I am. I thought it was wonderful. I've heard a lot of guys in the room saying that, you know, when they were drinking, they thought they were God's gift to women. I never thought that. I knew it. You know, the second step in this program was the single most difficult one for me, because the second step says that we came to believe that a power greater than myself. I didn't believe in a power greater than myself. You see, the religion I was brought up to believe in, I was brought up to believe in this God of hellfire and damnation. And I knew since I was that size that I was going to roast in hell. I knew that. And I got to the stage in my early life where I thought, well, might as well be hung for a sheep as a lamb. I just carried on my way, you know, to hell with God. I didn't need that. But you see, Andy kept talking to me about a loving God. And I just could not comprehend a loving God. You know, and they say there's no bosses in AA. What does it say in the second tradition? It says there is one ultimate authority, a loving God. And Andy said to me, he said, but Willie, that God that you believed in, he didn't help you, he didn't work for you. Why don't you pick a new God? I thought he was crazy. You know? But again, in this book, it says, you know, I can choose any conception of God that I like, providing it makes sense to me. And even today, it does not make sense to me to believe in a vindictive God. Don't we? You know, and again, the study in the book, it says that all I need to begin with is just to have the willingness. And it goes on to say that as soon as a person can say that he is willing to believe in a higher power, we emphatically assure him that he's on his way. And certainly in my case, what at first seemed to be a flimsy reed really did turn out to be the loving hand of God. Now I'm only 2 weeks sober. 2 weeks. And by that time I changed my attitude. And I was willing to believe in a loving God. And I'm 2 weeks sober and I'm standing in the main street in the town that I grew up in. And I'm standing talking to a guy. And it was just a feeling that I had. And I can't describe it any better than I'm trying to do it right now. It was just a feeling. And I knew in my head, and I knew in my heart, that I would never drink again. I knew it. But I was so scared to tell anybody about that. And I waited till I was about 6 months sober. I had never been 6 months sober. That's when I started telling people. Incredible. That's why I can certainly stand here tonight and say without fear of contradiction from anybody that my God has done for me what I couldn't do for myself. And in the second step it says it restores the sanity. The sanity part they talk about in the second step is not just the stupid, daft, crazy things that we do when we're drunk. That's drunkenness. This book talks about the subtle insanity that happens to me when I'm stone cold sober. The little thoughts in your head, and I can identify with this, that you would look back and you would think, well, maybe it wasn't really as bad as all that. This time it'll be different. You know, I had a thousand excuses to take a drink. I didn't have one good reason. If it's a hot day in the summer, you've got cold pint of beer to cool you down. It's a cold day in the winter, a couple of wee goldies will heat you up. Your team wins, you think to celebrate, they defeat you down your sorrows. Somebody gets married, you know the score. Any excuse, and not one good reason. And you know, in this book it tells me, you know, that there are only two kinds of will. There is self-will and there's God's will. And if I want to live long and happy and sober in this life, one of these wills has got to go. And I knew which one it was, and that's self-will. But you see, again, the book goes even further, because it tells me in there in black and white, it says that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Or if you like, if you turn that around, what it says to me is, see if you want your life to be a success, Stop trying to run it. That's what I did. When I came to step three in the book, I knelt down in my bedroom at night and read the prayer right out of the book. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Believe me of the bondage of self, and I may better do thy will. Then I came to step four. And there was the example in the book about Mr. Brown and Mrs. Jones. And I couldn't make head nor tail of that. Could not make head nor tail of that. And if you believe in coincidences, here's a cracker for you. This is 1985. The same priest that I was sent to in 1970, 25 miles away in Hamilton, he had been moved into the Chipley Parish less than a mile from where I lived. He was at the bottom of the road, Father Isaac Flavin. And I went down to ask, I went down to speak to Isaac. And I said to him, you know, I'm looking for advice in the fourth step. He said, okay. He said, if you're looking for advice in the fourth step, he said, I would assume that you've not taken the third step. I said, yeah. He said, how did you do it? And I told him. I knelt down in my bedroom. He said, okay. He said, do you mind if we do it again, the two of us? So the two of us knelt down and we said the first step prayer. When we stood up, he looked at me and he said, now if you were sincere about the decision you've made, he said, by now you should be trusting in God. He said, and if you trust in God, he will not allow anything bad to happen to you. You know, in chapter 5 it says, we stood at the turning point, we asked his care and protection with complete abandon. And he said, well, Willie, all you have to do from today on, and if you forget anything that I see here tonight, please remember this. Because he said to me, all you have to do from today on is just learn to accept everything that happens to you today. The good and the bad. Don't argue. Don't struggle. Don't fight it. Just accept it as being God's will for you. Just for today. And do the same thing tomorrow. And I remember looking at him, and I remember thinking to myself, shit, that will never work. But I'm going to try it. Just to prove you wrong. You know, I've been doing that now for the last 25 days and 28 years. 3 weeks ago I was 28 years sober. Isn't that a miracle? So we came to the wording in the fourth step. And he said, okay, let's read what it says in the fourth step. And just before he said that, at that time in our area, people had started handing out the Joan Charlie four-step inventory guides. And I took a copy of it down with me. And Father McLaren had never seen one. He was about 25 years sober at that time. He'd never seen one. And I had never seen one. And he said, well, he said, all right, he said, let's see what the book says about it. And he showed me the part in the book that it says, and don't take my word for this, go and find it yourself in the book. In the book it says that you might not overcome drinking till you tell someone else all your life story. That's what it says in there. So he said to me that day, he said, now I don't want you to tell me anything. I want you to go home and get yourself a writing pad and write down everything you can remember up until you were 15. And you know in chapter 5 it says that some of these be bought. I remember saying to him, I believe me a minute, Pat. I didn't start drinking till I was about 21, 22. He just smiled. He said, Willie, go home and get a writing pad. And start writing it down. It took me about a month. And I'd either be walking down the street or sitting on the bus or wherever. And some of the memories that come back to me even from my childhood, and I would just jot them down, then I could expand on them later on. Eventually I went down and I shared all that with Father McLaren. And he was able to show me just by what I've written that I suffered from the effects of this illness through my mother and father's alcoholism since I was that size. And when I was leaving him that day, he said, I want you to carry on doing the same thing with the rest of your life in 5-year cycles. from your 15 to your 20 and 20, 25. And he said, I've got no idea the things that you might tell me happened in your later life when you left high school, when you went to London. He said, you worked in the gambling industry, right? I said, yeah. He said, okay. He said, I'll have a bet for you right now. That it was just a repetition of everything you did up until you were 15. And I remember looking at him and thinking, are you in for a surprise, pal? The things I had done. I was a user and abuser of people, as a con artist. A user and abuser of women, in particular. With no thought or consideration for their feelings or emotions. Not at all. I was a thief and a liar and a cheat. And my sex life up there was 15, I'm still not too proud of that. But that set the pattern for the rest of my life. By the time I finished the fourth step, I decided I was going to share it with Andy Davison, the guy that introduced me to the program. And Andy came to my house one Sunday morning, and even when Andy came, I was still a bit fearful and apprehensive over certain things that I had done in my life, mainly to do with sex, that I vowed I will never share with another living soul. I'll take them to the grave with me first. And after my last drink, I nearly did that. But thank God for Andy Davison, because Andy came that morning. And before I got a chance to say anything, Andy started and he shared in great depth the things that he had done. Then I knew that I wasn't unique. And I wasn't the pervert that I thought I was. When it came to the fourth step, Father Flan had said to me, there are four me's in the fourth step. And I didn't know what he was talking about. And he said, it's not the nice, be quiet family man that you wanted everybody to think that you were. And I could identify with that one. He said, it's not the genius that you believed in your own mind that you were. And I could identify with that one. And he said, it's not the right bastard that you believed in your own heart that you were. And I knew that one well. The worst part of my day, every day when I was drinking, was I'd be standing in the bathroom in the morning getting shaved before I went to work. And I didn't like what I was looking at in the mirror. Then I'd walk out of there and I'd look at the innocent faces of my three young children and my wife. And the only thing that took all that pain away, all that deep, intense psychological pain, was lifting another glass and here we go again. I'll show them. But that morning after Andy shared with me, that's what gave me the courage and the confidence to go on and admit the exact nature of my wrongs. That session lasted about 6 hours. I remember at the end of it, I felt physically drained. It was a long session. But mentally or emotionally or spiritually, or call it what you like, I felt as high as a kite. I felt as though there was a tremendous weight lifted off me. I've heard Chuck Chamberlain, and some of you maybe have read his book or listened to him, and I heard him describing it, and he said it felt like an inside shower. And that's just the way it felt for me. I felt clean for the first time in my life. Clean on the inside as well as the outside. That night I wanted to run out and tell everybody I've taken the first step. Probably felt it was crazy. Probably was. Again, going back to this book, it says, once we finish the fifth step, it says, on returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, 1 hour. And taking the book down from the shelf, it says, this brings us to step six. And step six is only a prayer. It's only 8 lines. And at the end of that prayer, it says, you have now completed step seven. So 6 and 7 is no big deal. This whole program is no big deal, providing you follow the directions in this book. So that brought me on to the 8th step. And I remember saying to Andy, I can't do this. The 8th step, it says we made a list of the people we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. I said, Andy, I wish they'd have left out the last word, all. Because there's one guy that I would never make amends to. I told you about the Catholic priest that gave me the last rites in 1971. he used to come and visit with me. He became like the brother that I never had. We went everywhere together. We drank together. You know, he would come to my house once or twice a week, and a little bit of white plastic would come out and be chucked in the corner. He'd get me a briefcase and it would come out with a bottle of whiskey, and I'd come out with a bottle of whiskey, and we'd sit drinking half the night. And he'd leave my house in the middle of the night, legless. He could hardly stand in his car to drive home. And I'd be in my car, legless, to follow him to make sure he got home all right. You know, they always had a bottle of whiskey in their love compartment. You know, but I said to Andy, you know, Andy, I'll never make amends to that man. That man ended up marrying my wife. And that is fact. That is fact. And at one point I had said to the guy, right to his face, if I ever see you in this area again, I'll put this car right over the effing top of you. And he knew I meant it. I'm not proud when I tell you that the last several years of my mother's life, she lived in abject terror that I was going to end up serving a life sentence for killing this guy. Because my family knew the violence that I was capable of. They knew. I was vicious and vindictive. And for me, it was just a matter of a phone call. Then they crossed me, well, you're going to the hospital, Pat. And I'll come and visit you. You know, it didn't matter how much it cost me. That's the kind of guy I was. But Andy said to me, well, Willie, he said, you're going to have to pray for him. And I said, pray for him? Pray for him? I'd bury him in my front garden. And Andy said, well, it's up to you. You'll drink again. And that really stopped me in my tracks. Because I didn't ever want to go back to the hell that I came out of. And I started praying for that guy. And I didn't mean it at first. But the longer I was sober, that I kept praying, it got to the stage eventually where I was asking my God to give that man the same blessings as he had given me. Step 9 asking, the wording again is precise. It says we made direct amends. Direct means face to face. It's not about running around and knocking on doors and saying I'm sorry. I did that all my life. Said I was sorry a million times. Never meant it once. You know, to the best of my ability, I've made direct amends to a lot of people. A lot of them, the best way for me to make amends to them was to get the hell out of their life and let them go on with their life. I've still got some more to make. I'm not finished. And that's the beauty of this program, because we never finish with it. Step 10 asked me to look for four things. Selfishness, dishonesty, resentment and fear. And it tells me when to take it. It says when we retire at night, we constructively review our day, where have we been wrong, and it tells us what to do about it. And that's just going through step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 at night on a daily basis. Step 11 talks about prayer and meditation. And for me, prayer is just talking to my God, and meditation is listening to my God. And I don't go in for a lot of formalized prayers. I just speak to my God the way that I speak to you. There's a few that I do use, the third step, the seventh step. Did you know there was a four-step prayer? There's a four-step prayer. And I love the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi. And there's another prayer that I picked up from a New York gangster. His name was Jack Brennan. And he calls it the secret. And it says, I meet my God in the morning, when my day is at its best, and his presence comes at sunrise, like a glory in my breast. And all day long his presence lingers, and all day long he stays with me. And we sail in perfect calmness over a very troubled sea. So I think I know the secret. Learn from many a troubled way. You must seek him in the morning if you want him throughout the day. There's another prayer that I love. It's the prayer of St. Augustine. Over here you call him St. Augustine. It's okay. I won't hold it against you. But if any of you have ever read his life story, The True Confessions of St. Augustine, do yourself a favour and read that. He was one of us. I'm sure of it. That guy was into wine, women, and song every night of the week. But every night before he went to bed, he would kneel down and he would say, "Father, make me a saint, but not yet." Step 12 is one of the reasons why I'm here tonight. And again, the warning in step 12, you know, it tells me that it says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. The result of these steps is a spiritual awakening. I've had many, many, many spiritual awakenings. Then it asked me to do something very specific. It asked me to try and carry this message. Not the message, this message. And at the beginning I didn't know what this message was. And again, thank God for Andy Davison, because Andy opened the book, and this is a third edition. And in the inside fly cover, about halfway down, it says that this is the basic text, New and Revised, that the pages 1 to 164 remains unchanged. Then it says, this is the AA message. That's it, Pat. And if I don't know what it says in the first 164 pages of this book, and I haven't applied it into my life, and if I haven't reaped the benefits of what this program has got to offer, then how in the name of God can I try and carry this message? It's a powerful message. You know, looking back over all the years, you know, I don't believe that my God removed the obsession to drink. Because if he did that, that would create a vacuum. I choose to believe that my God replaced my obsession to drink with an obsession to stay sober and to help other people. You must have to try and carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs. I used to think the word affairs meant affairs. But you know, they asked me to throw in practice principles. And all the years I was drinking, I lived by principles. They were my principles. You know, some of the principles I lived by were, you know, if at first you don't succeed, cheat. That was it. What's perfect? Another one was, do unto others as they would do unto you, only do it first. Another one was, honesty is the best poverty. Poverty, being poor. Honesty is the best poverty. As I said earlier, I worked with all these bookmakers. And they were the guys with all the money. And I was the guy with all the brains. And if they would have paid me what I was really worth, I wouldn't have had to have stolen from them. You know, every bookmaker that I work for, you know, I never get caught once. Not once. You know? Jeez. And that took me for plenty, I can assure you. I'm going to backtrack. I won't take too long, Brent. I started coming over here in January of 1991 on vacation, because I'd been sitting at home listening to a lot of American, and I stress American, circuit speakers on cassettes. And I knew, it's a different fellowship over here. It really is. And it was my ambition to come over here just to go to meetings. That's why I came. And some of my friends at home, they heard I was going to Orlando, and they were saying, "Well, wait till you see the Magic Kingdom." And I'm not interested. If the crowds are going that way, I'm going that way. I come over here. I'll give you. I don't want to take a lot. Listen, I'd be here all night. Trust me. You don't know me. There's people in this room that know me. You know, I'm a man of very few words. And if you believe that, I'll sell you some Enron shares. You know. Oh my God, I've got a lot of mileage on my mouth. I'll take you back to March of 1994. I'd been over here for 3 months I came before Christmas. Oh, you always came twice a year. I'd come for the whole month of July, and I'd come back again before Christmas for 3 months every year. Because after I get sober, I get back into business again. And you want another miracle? The first 3.5 years I was sober, I was unemployed and unemployable and living in welfare. And my ex-wife, you know, I'd be lucky if I saw my two daughters maybe once a month or every couple of weeks. And she wouldn't give me any photographs of them. So what I did was I brought a little cheap plastic camera. And any time I saw my two daughters, I would take pictures of them for me. And during that first 3.5 years, I went on a Monday night and I joined the local photographic society. I ended up working professionally all over the whole of Britain every week. And I never advertised once. My God just opens doors for me and he puts people in front of me. And I'll make all you guys jealous tonight. And I'll tell you what I worked at. I was the official photographer at all the big dancing competitions all over Britain. The Scottish Highland Irish Disco Ballroom Line. You ever watch Dancing with the Stars? The guy I saw in there, Len Goodman. I've known Len Goodman for over 20 years. You know, I used to go to all his competitions. You know, absolutely incredible. You know, in a lot of these competitions, and I love to tell the guys in AA, I photographed some of the most beautiful looking women and girls all over the country. And at times, they had hardly any clothes on. And they paid me. Don't tell me God has a sense of humor. You know? I mean, the kind of guy I was, you know, when I was drinking, your granny wouldn't have been safe. By 1994, I'm back home in Glasgow, and I went to the local Monday night meeting, and I'd been going there for years, and I knew everybody in the room. Now, this particular night, there was a big guy sitting down on his own, and I went down and stuck my hand out, and as soon as I heard him saying, my name is John, and I heard the American accent, and I said to him, are you here on vacation, John? And he said, no. He said, I'm here as part of my job. So, of course, the next question is, what do you work at? And he said, I'm a Catholic priest. And at the end of that meeting, he asked me if I'd sponsor. Father John was... He was the director of the Missionaries of Africa. He's now back up in Washington, D.C. And today, the 18th of April, is his 77th belly button birthday. Okay. There's some of my group members through at Central. They've met him. Because from time to time, he'll come down and stay with me for a few days or a week. He's an incredible man. And when we get together, the only thing we never talk about is religion. We'll talk about AA. That's what we talk about. I won't keep you much longer. I'll take you back to the summer of 1998. My youngest daughter, Geraldine, she was only 32. I hadn't seen her for more than 10 years. During the summer, I got a letter from her to tell me that she was a patient in a local psychiatric hospital where I go and see her. I was in the hospital within an hour of seeing that letter, and I didn't even recognize her. She was like something out of Biafra, just skin and bone. Geraldine had been a nurse, and in treating some of the patients, she'd injured her back trying to lift one of them, which is a common complaint in nurses. She was just a little girl. And because of that, eventually she had to give up nursing. And she became addicted to prescription drugs. They allowed her out of the hospital a few days later. And for the next 6 months, my business came to a standstill. I spent every day or every evening either with Geraldine at her home or in my home. And I tried my damnedest to try and help her. And I was getting nowhere. on the 2nd of January, 1999. I was asked to speak at a meeting not far from where I lived. And I was telling the people in the room about my daughter Geraldine that night. Some of them knew her. And I remember saying to them during the meeting that I had to admit that I was powerless over Geraldine, that she made my life unmanageable. And I had come to believe that only a power greater than me could restore her to sanity. And I made a decision that night to turn her will and her life over to the care of my God. That was Saturday night, the 2nd of January, 1999. On the Tuesday afternoon, at 2 o'clock, I got a phone call from my son that I hadn't even spoken to in 15 years. And my son told me that Geraldine was dead. She had hanged herself. And that my ex-wife, they'd been to the house, they couldn't get in because Geraldine refused to give her mother a key. But Geraldine's car was there and they could hear the dog barking. They had to send for the cops to break in. This is the Tuesday afternoon. I assumed that Geraldine had hanged herself on the Monday night. We got the autopsy report on the Wednesday. And that's when they told us that Geraldine had hanged herself on the Saturday night, the night I was speaking at the meeting. The things that happened in the next week, trust me, I'd be here all week telling you about. But I thank God at that time for all the friends I'd made over here. Because even at home, my house was packed every day and every night with some of my own family, a small army of VA members, friends that I knew through work. You know, when it came 11, 12 o'clock at night, they would all go home because they've got their own families and jobs to go to. But you see, when it's midnight in Scotland, it's only 7 o'clock in the evening over here. And I was on the phone every night for hours. I didn't care how much it cost, breaking my heart crying. And I would phone my friend Jack that I stayed with in Orlando, Joe and Deborah Kelly down in Naples in Florida. I'd phone Father John up in Washington DC. I'd get friends all over the place. And I needed all that help at that time. The things that happened in that chapel the day of my daughter's funeral, when the man who had married my wife, the priest, that for years my three kids had called him father, my wife insisted that they end up calling him dad. And he got up in the pulpit that day at the funeral. And the chapel was packed. And he was trying to give everybody in the chapel the impression that he was Geraldine's father. You have no idea what it felt like. No idea. The next 12 months after that, and again, please believe me, I do not exaggerate. You know, they say that fact is stranger than fiction. Believe it. For the next 12 months, it seemed as though I'd been hit by a series of express trains. I lost three of my sisters through alcoholism. Three of them died. My older sister, Kathleen, she'd been in and out of AA. She got involved with a guy in AA. The doctors had told her 6 months before she died that her liver and kidneys were gone and she needed to stop drinking right now. And Kathleen carried on drinking. Her body blew apart. Another one of my sisters, Pat. I tried for over 15 years to help my sister Pat and her husband. And if my sister Pat was here right now, she would swear on a stack of Bibles that she did not have a drink problem. That was her truth. In spite of the fact that the cops were never away from their door. In spite of the fact that her husband used to come up to my house at night, terrified. He would barricade himself in his bedroom because Pat was trying to smash the door down. In spite of the fact that all the neighbours in the street had got up a petition to get him evicted. Pat ended up with Korsakoff psychosis. That's a wet brain. And I was with Pop when she died. It took a long time to die. No idea. It was a young nephew of mine committed suicide. There were several other people that I knew they all died. Within that year, it was one after the other. But you know, the miracle of this program is that during all of that sadness or madness, and I swear to God, the thought of a drink never even crossed my mind. Never crossed my mind. That's the miracle of this program. Now, I'm not a big book salesman. You know, but I often wonder, if our co-founders were here tonight, I wonder what they would say. And somehow I can hear Dr. Silver saying that I urge every alcoholic to read this book through this one. And though perhaps you came to scoff, you may remain to pray. I can hear Bill Wilson saying, if you're an alcoholic and wants to get over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do? And he says it's the purpose of this book to answer these questions specifically. This book gives me specific, precise, and clear-cut directions how to live my life, how to take these steps. I can hear Dr. Bob, the quiet man in AA, I can hear him saying, if you think you're an atheist, or an agnostic, or a skeptic, or suffer from any other form of intellectual pride which prevents you from accepting what's in this book, I feel sorry for you. And I would like to add, so do I. I'm going to finish this up now by using the words of Father Isaac McLaren. And Father McLaren will never be dead as long as I'm alive. But any time that Father McLaren spoke at a meeting, he would always end up by saying that Alcoholics Anonymous didn't come into existence to make life easy, but it did come into existence to make men and women great. And I would like to thank each and every one of you tonight for listening to me, because tonight again, I feel great. Thank you.